Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, it's Free for All Friday on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today what I want to talk about are misunderstandings in literature. When I go online, I'll see quotes, inspirational graphics. You see this on Instagram all the time. People will take a quote from a famous play or a poem and then put a picture of themselves walking on the beach or hiking up a mountain, and they get the exact, they get the meaning of the quote actually backwards when they're sharing it. And this happens to all of us, myself included. I think I remember something I read in high school and I'll quote it. And then now I go back to the original source and find out, oh, wait, never mind. I had that completely wrong my whole life. So it's a learning experience for all of us. That's what I want to talk about today. But before we do that, I have two favors. If you are listening to this on podcast, go check us out on YouTube. Click subscribe. I really want to help our YouTube channel to grow and reach other people. If you're watching on YouTube, just click the subscribe button. That doesn't take too long to do. If you're watching on YouTube or listening on podcasts, head over to Apple, iTunes, or Google Play. Leave a review for the podcast there. That's really helped a lot of people to get to know the Council of Trent. We're near 1,500 reviews on Apple iTunes. We're definitely in the upper tier of Catholic podcasts. And I'm really grateful for everyone who's listened, who supported us over the last 2 years, going on almost 3 years now, I think, of doing this podcast. Your support, really just word of mouth, letting people know what we're doing at the Council of Trent, has been really helpful. So thank you so much for that. And if, of course, you want to support us financially to help us to grow and do more YouTube channel videos, rebuttal videos, go to TrenthornPodcast.com. All right, so today I want to talk about misunderstood literature. And what's funny is if you Google misunderstood poetry or misunderstood literature, the very first thing that comes up is the poem The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. So you probably read this poem in high school, but you, even if you haven't, I'm sure you know the first line of the poem and the last part of the poem. So the first line always is in like motivational posters. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And so that's the first line. Then the last line, well, it gets re-summarized again at the end. So most people know that the last three lines of the poem, the ending. Two roads diverged in a wood. They missed the yellow wood part. That's how the poem begins. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. So very famous poem. And you'll look on Instagram and other places, and people will show an image of a path that has overgrown leaves. And they think that, oh, and they'll put the quote, and they think that the meaning of The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost, they think that the meaning of the poem is that you should go against the grain. You know, you should not do what everyone else do. And everyone else is going down the really popular road, but you'll be really happy and fulfilled if you take the less popular route. Don't go with the crowd. Be true to yourself. That's another one that's misquoted from literary history we'll get to here shortly. But that's not the meaning of the poem at all. In fact, the poem, The Road Not Taken, I would say its primary meaning is stop worrying about the path you didn't take, because they're all basically the same anyways. I mean, wow, that's quite the opposite of what you thought the poem was about, thinking, oh, The Road Not Taken, and I took the path less traveled. That made all the difference. Go against the grain. Be yourself. No, really what the poem is more about is that the paths we choose in life, a lot of them are really the same. And if we spend a bunch of time regretting the paths we didn't take, it's gonna drive us crazy. And what we'll end up doing is we'll rationalize after the fact, trying to say the path we took was special in order to get over our regret of not doing the other choice in life. To understand that, I'm just going to read the poem to you because it's short, and you might be able to see this more as I read it through. So here is The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. So the narrator already seems kind of indecisive. In fact, Frost wrote this poem, sorry to break it up here, but I need to interject. Frost actually wrote this poem about a friend of his who was incredibly indecisive and couldn't figure out what he wanted to do in life. That was the inspiration of the poem. So you notice with the narrator, he says, oh, I'm going to take this other path because it was grassy and wanted wear. But actually, they had both been worn about the same. So he's thinking, oh, this is the path less traveled. I'll take it. Ah, they're actually really both the same. This is not the most reliable narrator that we're listening to. And hey, unreliable narrator is going to come up here in another misunderstood piece of literature. So keep that in your hats. So it continues. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden back. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. And I took the one path, but who knows if I'm ever going to come back and take the other one. See, it's about indecisiveness. I shall be telling this, and here's the kicker, I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. We don't know exactly what that means. It could be ironic. It could be a depressed sigh. So you need to read that before the last line. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. And then the end. Two roads diverged in a wood. And I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. So you have to imagine that the narrator is saying with a sigh, yeah, I took that other road. And yeah, it was that made the difference, I guess. So the message then from the story, Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken, don't worry about the road that you didn't take. Odds are it's pretty similar to the one you did, but you can't live in the past. You can't live in the decisions you didn't make. You have to live in the decisions that you did make. I did a show actually a while ago, Free For All Friday, on poetry. And I remember, I think we read The Road Not Taken, I don't know, junior year of high school. And I was a little punk in high school. I said, poetry's lame. Anybody can make up this stuff. It's not a big deal. And so our teacher said, it's not lame, Mr. Horn. Your assignment is everyone is to bring in a poem to discuss in class. And so we all came in and I brought in a poem. It was some poem about how a guy went into a garden and he picked a flower. He wanted to pick another one. And it's supposed to be it was supposed to be symbolic about romantic relationships, and he went back and the other flower wasn't there anymore and he was all sad. I don't know. I talk about this poem with disdain because my English teacher said, wow, that's a very beautiful poem. Who wrote it? And I said to the teacher, I wrote it. It doesn't mean anything, or if it does, it's shallow. See, anybody can come up with this stuff. She was not happy after I did that. So I was such a little punk. Maybe I'm still a punk now in some respects. So, but now as I've gotten older, I see, well, no, there is, just like there's bad movies, bad TV, there's bad poetry, but that doesn't take away from good poetry that actually stirs and moves the soul to contemplate things. So, all right, here's the next one I want to go to is Shakespeare. I'm going to give three examples of famous lines in Shakespeare that are misunderstood. I would say the most famous one that is misunderstood is from Act 2, Scene 2 of Romeo and Juliet, where Juliet is out on the balcony and she says, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo? Because a lot of people, when they recite this line, they think that Juliet has just burst out onto the balcony and she has no idea where Romeo is. She's like, Romeo, Romeo, where are you, Romeo? Where are you? Get over here. I need you. Where are you? And that's not what is going on. Juliet is aware of Romeo's presence, but she's speaking to herself and doesn't realize that Romeo can hear her. And so when she says, wherefore art thou Romeo, she's not asking where he is. Wherefore in Shakespearean English at that time did not mean like where your location. It meant more why. So what Juliet's really saying is, why are you Romeo? And that is clear in the context. So I have up here on the screen, this is from Spark Notes, as the original Shakespeare, and then the translation to help high school students and really anybody else to get through it, because there's going to be references you don't understand, like wherefore, for example. Many people don't understand what it meant in the original language. So it says, it goes here, O Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo? Deny thy father and refuse thy name. Or if thou wilt not be but sworn my love, and I'll no longer be a Capulet. So in saying, wherefore art thou Romeo, she's basically saying, so in the translation, the modern translation, Oh, Romeo, Romeo, why do you have to be Romeo? Forget about your father and change your name. Or else if you won't change your name, just swear you love me and I'll stop being a Capulet. I wish somebody, it'd be a fun gag at a Shakespearean theater company with like actors acting, you know, who are very into their roles and professional, who acted out, somebody, okay, someone take this idea and run with it. I want to get like a British Shakespearean company, Globe Theater, the best of the best professionals, and they do a medley of Shakespeare, but the lines are just the modern translations from Spark Notes. Oh, Romeo, why do you have to be such a Romeo? Forget about your father and change your name and let's just get married already. That, I think, would be hilarious if they did that. But so that's what's going on here. She's saying, why do you have to be a Montague? Why am I a Capulet? Our families hate each other. Why is this happening that's beyond our control? Why can't we just get married and be with one another apart from all of this family baggage? So that's one from Romeo and Juliet. The other one is from Shakespeare. That would be in Act 1, Scene 3 of Hamlet. This is where Polonius is advising his son Laertes. Polonius is an advisor to the king, the evil king, who killed his brother and usurped the throne. And then Hamlet has become aware of this because the ghost of his dead father has appeared to him and is now telling him, you know, what's happening here, telling to him and Horatio. You know what's funny, actually, I'm gonna drop in here right now in the episode. A while ago, Matthew, my 6-year-old, he was reading these Usborne books that are summaries of Shakespeare, and Hamlet is probably his favorite story. He actually asked me to read it to him when he was really little. I think he was like 4 years old, and he asked me, "Dad, can you read Helmet to me?" I said, "Oh, you want Hamlet? Okay." So I'd read him the Usborne book, and he loved it. I mean, and he still likes it. So he actually recited the entire story to me the other day. And he did it. He wanted to share with everyone who supports TrenthornPodcast.com. So I recorded it. I'll share that with the patrons, but I'll share a quick clip of him, of my son Matthew reciting Hamlet. Well, not reciting it, but retelling the story of Hamlet as he understands it.
So they go out the door, and then Hamlet almost freezes for what he sees once more is the dead king. Then Hamlet says, "Father, how are you alive?" The king says nothing. He beckons to him. "Step forward." So Hamlet goes very slowly, and then he says, "Why?" And then Hamlet says, "Why did my mother marry your uncle? Marry my uncle?" So the dead king slings everything.
So what happened?
So he explains.
So if you want to hear Matthew's entire retelling of Hamlet, become a patron at TrenthornPodcast.com. I'll post the video right after this episode. But I love that little guy. He's going to go on to do some really good things. So, all right, so back to Hamlet, though. Act 1, Scene 3. Polonius is advising Laertes about his studies. I think he's going off to Paris, and he's giving him different bits of advice. And one of them is something that is quoted all the time you see online, and that is, "This above all, to thine own self be true." Now, the problem is that in Elizabethan English that Shakespeare's writing in 400 years ago, the word true in this context is closer to good, like be good to yourself. Like we would say, hey, be good to yourself, like put yourself first. That's really more what Polonius is talking about here. Because he's giving his son Laertes advice for when he's going out. He's saying, "Costly thy habit as thy purse can buy, but not expressed in fancy, rich, not gaudy." So be rich, but not showy. "For the apparel oft proclaims the man," you know, the dress for success, you know, the way you dress shows yourself to others. "And they in France of the best rank and station are of a most select and generous chief in that. Neither a borrower nor a lender be, For loan oft loses both itself and friend. That's good advice. Don't loan money to friends. You're either going to lose the money or you're going to lose a friend, or both. And borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. This above all, to thine own self be true. And we see this in the modern commentary. When you lend to a friend, you lose the friendship and the money. Borrowing turns a person into a spendthrift. And above all, be true to yourself. But that leads astray. He's saying more, look, Laertes, when you go to Paris, put yourself first. Keep your own interests first. And now it's a tad ironic, though, because in Hamlet, Polonius is a character who's, you don't want to emulate him. His children make fun of him. He tries to orchestrate affairs within the royal household, and things often go awry as a result of it. So Polonius is not the person you're going to want to be taking advice from, given the situations he ends up in, including how he ends up getting himself killed, which I'm not going to spoil. You can either read Hamlet, watch one of the film adaptations, or listen to Matthew tell about it at trendhornpodcast.com. So to thine own self be true. That's just Shakespeare's way of saying, hey, put yourself first. All right. Take care of yourself before you take care of other people. And finally, the next one I want to look at is from The Merry Wives of Windsor, which is a comedy. This is from Act 2, Scene 2, and is the genesis of the phrase, the world's your oyster. You've probably heard that. People tell you, oh, you have a lot of gifts and skills. Go out in the world. The world's your oyster. The idea is that people think that the phrase means that oysters have pearls in them. So get out there, get out in the world, get the pearl, get the treasure. The world's your oyster. The pearl is just waiting for you. But actually, in its original context, it's more of a threat of violence. So The Merry Wives of Windsor is a comedy featuring a character. It's actually a spinoff. So we complain about spinoffs today, like, oh, why are we doing a spinoff with this character? That happened even in Shakespeare's time. So in the play Henry IV, there is a nice way of saying fat, a portly, wisecracking con man named Falstaff. I think his name's John Falstaff. And so Falstaff became a character that everybody fell in love with. They're like, I can't get enough of Falstaff. And so they're like, wait, what if Falstaff got married, that delightful louse? And so that's what we find in The Merry Wives of Windsor. And in this scene, Act 2, Scene 2 at the Garter Inn, he's talking to one of his associates, Pistol. And I mean, these are not good people. Falstaff is going to try to seduce two wealthy women to try to get their money. And he's talking to his friend Pistol, and Falstaff says to him, I will not lend thee a penny. And Pistol says, why then? The world's mine oyster, with which I with sword will open. I will retort the sum and equipage. And Falstaff just replies, not a penny. Falstaff's telling Pistol, I'm not going to give you any money. And Pistol says, hey, look, buddy, the world's my oyster, and I'll use a sword to crack it open if I have to. You're going to get me that money, or I will resort to violence. Falstaff says, nah, I'm not going to give you the money. Because you think about it, the world's your oyster. How do you get into an oyster? You need a knife to crack it open. Oysters are really hard to get into to get the pearl. So it's not the world's your oyster. Pistol says, why then the world's mine oyster, which I with sword will open? So the actual original meaning of the phrase, it's taken on a new meaning as it's been articulated over the years, is actually about, hey, if the treasure is there, I'll do what it takes to get it, including an act of violence if I have to. All right, so the last pieces of literature I want to talk about are not so much quotations that are misunderstood, but general themes that are misunderstood. One would be Fahrenheit 451 by sci-fi author Ray Bradbury. So Fahrenheit 451 is about Guy Montag. He is a firefighter. The book takes place in the future. I think it's set like 60 or 80 years into the future. He's not a firefighter. He is a fireman. But his job is not to put out fires. It's to start fires. He goes to buildings where books have been outlawed. And so he goes and he burns down buildings that have these illegal books in them. And so a lot of people think that Fahrenheit 451 is only about censorship, about the dangers of censoring books, and, you know, we shouldn't engage in censorship because then good ideas will be censored along with bad ideas. And censorship is a major theme in Fahrenheit 451. But the other prominent theme, if not one of the main themes, is that television is bad. Bradbury didn't think that the government would be the thing that would take away all of our books from us and leave us in ignorance. He believed that television would do that in and of itself. When you read through Fahrenheit 451, you see a lot of descriptions of television. A lot of the events take place in television parlors. These are rooms in people's homes that have entire walls that are just giant television screens. There is a scene in the novel where Montag goes home to his wife, Mildred, and he's trying to talk to her about something really disturbing that happened to him at work. And she still has this giant TV on loud in the background. And he says, can you just turn the TV off? And she says, you know, that's my family. And she eventually agrees just to turn the volume down, but she can't turn the TV off. And television becomes family for people. I remember a priest told me once he went to give the anointing of the sick to a dying woman. And he goes in, and she's an elderly woman in her room with the TV going on really loud. And the priest said, you know, can you turn off the TV while I do this? And the caretaker said, that TV hasn't been turned off in 40 years. And so Bradbury is concerned that government won't be the thing that takes away our books. We'll just love television so much, we won't want to read books anymore. And so that's a major theme that often gets missed in Fahrenheit 451. Another one is Alice in Wonderland. There was a dissertation put out a few years ago. I read an article about it in 2009 in New Scientist magazine, saying that Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland, I believe it was published in 1865, that one of the prominent themes in Alice in Wonderland is math. I mean, think about it. The Mad Hatter, he has an improper fraction in his hat. That actually Carroll was lampooning or criticizing the new math that was being taught, because in the late 19th century, you have things like symbolic algebra, imaginary numbers. Soon after Carroll published Alice in Wonderland, George Cantor developed set theory to do mathematical operations with infinite sums. And so when you put that against the backdrop, you can see that Carroll, who was very interested in mathematics himself, Alice in Wonderland is a representation of how this new math makes the world topsy-turvy, difficult to understand, that traditional Euclidean geometry has to be put off to the side. And so the scene where you have the Mad Hatter and the mouse are trying to cram the mouse into the teapot is actually symbolic of trying to solve these newer math problems with the older methods, and you can't get them to work. There's the other scene where Alice eats a mushroom and she grows in size, and people think, oh, that's just about drugs. But in the scene, Alice is trying to figure out, she has to eat different parts of the mushroom, I believe, because she grows her chest and her neck at different rates. And so she has to grow them at the same rate in order to achieve the right effect. And that seemed to be Carroll talking about new forms of algebra and geometry that he felt didn't actually make sense. So Alice in Wonderland is not about drugs. It's actually about math. So something for you to consider and to maybe do more research in. Here's the last one, God is Dead, from Nietzsche. It first appears in a collection of writings called The Gay Science. It's more famous in his work, Thus Spake Zarathustra. And a lot of people just take just that phrase, God is dead, and they think of it as like a triumphal hymn. Like, God is dead, we don't need God anymore, everything is great. But that's not what Nietzsche was getting at. In The Gay Science, there is a passage called The Parable of the Madman, where the guy is running through a marketplace with a lantern. He's like, I see God. Where is God? Where is God? Everyone's laughing at him. And then he looks at them and it says, the madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. Whither is God? He cried. I will tell you. We have killed him. You and I, all of us are his murderers. And then it goes on, but you see it becomes more melancholy and depressed. But how did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night continually closing in on us? That it's actually something to be more, getting rid of God isn't something to celebrate, that the absence of God in modern man's life means he's been unchained from the one thing that gave the world morality, society, order, and continuity, and who knows where we will go when we unchain ourselves from that sure foundation. So Nietzsche, of course, was not a Christian. He didn't believe in these traditional ideals. We did recognize what happens when we move beyond them. So, hey, I hope that was helpful for you all. Thank you so much. Be sure to go to trendhornpodcast.com to be able to support what we're doing here, to be able to help to edify other people and to lead them closer to truth, and ultimately to truth that it's been revealed in the person who just is truth, Jesus Christ. So thank you, guys, and I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.